Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, 2023 was the warmest year on record. The World Meteorological Organization announced records once again broken, in some cases smashed, their words, for greenhouse gas levels, surface temperatures, ocean heat and acidification, sea level rise, Antarctic sea ice cover, and glacier retreat. Climate disruption is the prime mover of a cascade of interrelated crises. At the same time, we're told that basic journalism says that when it comes to problems that need to be solved, yet somehow are not, rule number one is follow the money. Yet, even as elite media talk about the climate crisis, they still can't quite connect images of floods or fires to those triumphant shareholder meetings of the fossil fuel companies. Narrating the nightmare is not enough. We'll talk about the latest research on climate coverage with Evlando Cooper, senior writer at Media Matters. Also on the show, part of what FAIR's been saying since our start in 1986, when it was a fringe idea that meant you were either alarmist or benighted or both, is that there is an inescapable conflict between media as a business and journalism as a public service. For a while, it was mainly about fear and favor, the way corporate owners and sponsors influence the content of coverage. It's more bare-knuckled now. Mass layoffs and takeovers force us to see how what you may think of as your local newspaper is really just an asset in a mega corporation's portfolio, and will be treated that way, with zero evidence that a source of vital news and information is any different from a soap factory. Rick Goldsmith's new film is called Stripped for Parts: American Journalism on the Brink. We'll hear from him about the film and the change it hopes to be part of. That's coming up this week on Counterspin, but first a quick look back at some recent press. Reporters can't be faulted for the headlines on their stories. They don't get to write them. Nevertheless, headlines are all many folks will read, and they convey the tone and emphasis that the outlet would have us take away. It's in that light that you read the passive, confusing word salad the New York Times offered February 29th. Quote, "As hungry Gazans crowd a convoy, a crush of bodies, Israeli gunshots, and a deathly toll." Close quote. That's about the incident in which more than 100 Palestinians were killed and hundreds more wounded when Israeli snipers opened fire on people approaching a convoy of trucks carrying supplies of flour, desperately needed in the circumstances of enforced starvation inflicted by the ongoing Israeli war on and displacement of Palestinian people. Other outlets, as Robin Anderson describes for FAIR.org, are referring to food aid-related deaths, as though it were relief efforts that were somehow killing Palestinians, rather than weapons paid for by the U.S. and employed by Israeli forces. And no, it isn't just with regard to U.S. involvement in violence elsewhere. The Times employs similar wordsmithery in covering for corporations that, well, sometimes make decisions that endanger human life. But listen, listen, it's because they need to make money. What else explains this corker from the paper in late January? Quote, "Boeing faces tricky balance between safety and financial performance," close quote. The subhead explains, quote, "The company is under pressure to show regulators and customers that it takes safety seriously and to reassure investors about its financial outlook," close quote. It might sound merely semantic, but the paper of record telling us that it deems the protection of human lives as, yes, important, but only as important and arguably less so than the next quarter's profits, well, that's a message we should heed. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. Climate disruption is, of course, one of the most disastrous phenomena of today's life, affecting every corner of the globe. It's also one of the most addressable. We know what causes it. We know what meaningful intervention would entail. So it's a human-made tragedy unfolding in real time before our eyes. To understate wildly, we need to be talking about it, learning about it, hearing about it urgently, which is why the results of our next guest's research are so alarming. I'll just spoil it. Broadcast news coverage of the climate crisis is going down. Evlando Cooper is a senior writer with the Climate and Energy Program at Media Matters for America. He joins us now by phone from Washington State. Welcome to Counterspin, Evlando Cooper.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited about our conversation today.
Well, we're talking about the latest of Media Matters' annual studies of climate crisis coverage. First of all, just tell us briefly what media you are looking at in these studies.
So we're looking at corporate broadcast network coverage. That's ABC, CBS, and NBC. And for the Sunday morning shows, we also include Fox Broadcasting, Fox News Sunday.
All right. And then for context, this decline in coverage that you found in the most recent study, that's down from very little to even less.
Yeah. So a little context, 2021 and 2022 were both record years for climate coverage. And that coverage was a little bit more than 1%. This year, we saw a 25% decrease from 2022, which brought coverage to a little bit less than 1%. So even in the years, and we want to encourage more coverage, but even in the years where they were doing phenomenal, it was only about 1% of total coverage. And so this kind of retrenchment by approximately 25% in 2023 is not a welcome sign, especially in a year where we saw record catastrophic extreme weather events. And scientists are predicting that 2024 might be even worse than 2023.
Well, let's break out some of the things that you found. When we're talking about such small numbers, and when you say 1%, that's 1% of all of the broadcast coverage of their stories. 1% were devoted to the climate crisis. But we've seen, you know, there's little things within it. For example, we are hearing more from actual climate scientists.
Yeah, that was a very encouraging sign where this year we saw 41 climate scientists appear, which was 10% of the featured guests in 2023. And that's up from 4% in 2022. So in terms of quality of coverage, I think we're seeing improvements. We're seeing a lot of the work being done by dedicated climate correspondents and meteorologists who are including climate coverage as part of their weather reports and their own correspondence segments, a bigger part of their reporting. So there are some encouraging signs. I think what concerns us is that these improvements, while important and necessary and appreciated, are not keeping up with the scale, the escalating scale of climate change.
Right. It's just not appropriate to the seriousness of the topic. And then another thing is, you could say the dominance of white men in the conversation, which I know is another finding, and that's just kind of par for the elite media course. When folks are talked to, they are overwhelmingly white men. But it might bear some relation to what you're seeing as an underrepresentation of climate-impacted populations, looking at folks at the sharp end of climate disruption. That's something you also consider.
Yeah, we look at coverage of broadly climate justice. I think a lot of people believe it's representation for representation's sake, right? But I think when people most impacted by climate change, and we're talking about communities of color, we're talking about low-income communities, we're talking about low-wealth rural communities, when these folks are left out of the conversation, you're missing important context about how climate change is impacting them, in many cases first and worse, and you're missing important context about the solutions that these communities are trying to employ to deal with it. And I think you're missing an opportunity to kind of humanize and broaden support for climate solutions at the public policy level. So these aren't communities where these random acts of God are occurring. These are policy decisions or indecisions that have created an environment where these communities are being most harmed, but least talked about, and they're receiving the least redress to their challenges. And so those voices are necessary to kind of tell those stories to a broad audience on the corporate broadcast network.
Yes, absolutely. Another finding that I thought was very interesting was that extreme weather seemed to be the biggest driver of climate coverage. And that, to me, suggests that the way corporate broadcast media are coming at climate disruption is reactive. Look at what happened.
Totally.
And even when they say, look at what's happening, and you know what? Folks pretty much agree that this is due to climate disruption, these houses sliding into the river, you know, it's still not saying, while you look at this disaster, know that this is preventable, and here is who is keeping us from acting on it and why.
Yeah, that is so insightful, because that's a kind of a core critique of even the best coverage we see, that there is no accountability for the fossil fuel industry and other industries that are driving the crisis. And then there's no real solutions are mentioned about 20% or mentioned about 20% of climate segments this year. But the solutions are kind of siloed, like there are solution segments. But to your point, when we're talking about extreme weather, when you have the most eyeballs hearing about climate change, to me, it would be very impactful to connect what's happening in that moment, these wildfires, these droughts, these heat waves, these hurricanes and storms and flooding, to connect that to a key driver, fossil fuel industry, and talk about some potential solutions to mitigate these impacts while people are actually paying the most attention.
And then, you know, take it to your next story about Congress or your next story about funding and,
exactly,
you know, connect those dots.
Exactly. I mean, climate is too often siloed, right? So you could see a really great segment, for instance, the Willow Project at the top of the hour. And this is on cable, so.
Right.
But the example remained.
Right.
And then late in the hour, you saw a story about an extreme weather event. But those things aren't connected. They're siloed. And so a key to improving coverage in an immediate way would be to understand that the climate crisis is kind of the background for a range of issues, social, economic, political. Begin incorporating climate coverage in a much broader swath of stories that, whether you know it or not, indirectly or directly, are being impacted by global warming.
It's almost as though corporate media have decided that another horrible disaster due to climate change, while it's a story, it's basically now like a dog bites man story, you know, and if they aren't going to explore these other angles, well, then there really isn't anything to report until the next drought or the next mudslide. And that's just a world away from what appropriate, fearless,
yes,
future believing journalism would be doing right now.
And it's out of step, right? Poll the poll showing that even some bipartisan support for climate action, from government climate action, because, you know, whether people know it or not, as far as the science and, you know, there's some deniers out there, but anecdotally, people know something is happening.
Mm-hmm.
Something is changing in their lives. We're seeing record-breaking things that no one's ever experienced, and they want the government to do something about it.
Right.
And so it's important to cover extreme weather and to cover these catastrophes. And I know there's a range of thought out there that says, you know, if you're just focusing on devastating impacts, it could dampen public action. But to me, to your point, report on it and connect it to solutions. Empower people to call their congressperson, their representative, their senator, to vote in ways that have local impacts, you know, to deal with the local climate impacts. It doesn't have to be about just showing the destruction and carnage. There are ways that you can empower people to take action in their own lives and to galvanize public support. And the public wants it. The public is asking for this. So I think just being responsive to what these polls are showing would be a way to immediately kind of improve the way that they cover climate change right now.
All right, then. We've been speaking with Evlando Cooper of Media Matters for America. You can find this work and much else at mediamatters.org. Evlando Cooper, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you for having me.
Documentary filmmakers don't start when the camera rolls. The work involves not just gathering knowledge on a topic, but establishing relationships, sometimes with people who have no reason to trust that a camera in their face will lead to anything good for them. Likewise, documentary filmmakers are not done when the film is finished. Especially in the media everywhere all the time world we live in now, simply creating something is not the same as guiding it to who might want or need to see it, to helping it have impact. Among his other work, Rick Goldsmith is the filmmaker behind two important films about journalism in the United States, Tell the Truth and Run, George Seldes and the American Press, and The Most Dangerous Man in America, Daniel Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers. His newest film is the third in this focused trilogy. It's called Stripped for Parts: American Journalism on the Brink. And he joins us now to talk about it. He's joining us from Oakland, California. Welcome back to Counterspin, Rick Goldsmith.
Hi, Janine. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Well, smart as we all are nowadays, I think the idea of capitalism as market-based, which seems to mean based on human choices, that's been sold so well as a story that there are people thinking, well, as much as I relied on my local newspaper, I guess it was just losing so much money that it wasn't a sustainable business, and so it had to die. The layoffs, the closures, what many people see as news media moving from far from perfect to what the hell, is presented as sad but somehow inevitable. And I think this film intervenes in that storyline. But was there a particular spark or a particular question that set you off to make Stripped for Parts?
There was an event that happened about 6 years ago now. It was called the Denver Rebellion. And what happened was the newspaper men and women at the Denver Post kind of rose up against their owner. It was a hedge fund. And it was newly understood that hedge funds had a really bad effect on journalism. And they criticized their own owners. They took it upon themselves. And this kind of decline in local journalism was noticed first by the journalists themselves. And they were the canaries in the coal mine to tell the story to everybody else. So what I found out when I found out about this uprising, the Denver Rebellion, there were several things that jumped out at me. One was, why would somebody try to intentionally run down journalism? And two, they were taking on, the hedge funds were taking on a business that was failing. Why would they do that, and how would they make money? And then three was, here were the journalists who usually don't even report on their own industry, and they were the ones telling the story. So for me, that was rich enough to get into it and say, what the heck is going on here? And can I add something to this story?
Well, I think that's especially interesting because accounts of what Amazon is doing or what the auto industry is doing, they're almost always about what the owners and shareholders are doing. And if it's a story about the workers, that's going to be another day on another page. And it's especially maybe true in media in that, as you've just said, workers, reporters, photographers usually don't feel that they can or should speak as workers. You know, for a journalist, making yourself the story, so-called, is anathema. So it wasn't so much what you're saying. You didn't have to get reporters to talk. Reporters were like, no, we want to get this story out.
That's right. And that was unique about their story, but I still had to, I think that the thing you said at the top about gaining their trust, I think was really, really important. And maybe it was because of my background, and maybe it was just because of the approach, or maybe it was because of the passion and the anger that they were feeling at the time at being downsized by this hedge fund, that they were open to talking to me. And I think those first interviews after the Denver Rebellion were very, very rich because it was so fresh in their mind and they were so fired up about it.
Well, what did you learn if you had to explain to someone why would a profit-interested corporation buy a paper and destroy it, essentially, run it into the ground? Well, how does that make sense? Does that make sense?
Well, it makes sense if you understand what this particular hedge fund and many like it are in the business of. And the key phrase here is distressed asset investing, which is maybe a kind of Wall Street-ish term. But what it means is they could buy something on the cheap that was a failing business, and then figure out what their assets were. And like a used car that is basically junk, they could strip it for parts. And in this case, it was usually the real estate. The newsroom itself was downtown, was centrally located, and they could buy the newspaper for a song, sell the building, maybe sell the printing press and move the printing operations out of town. And they've already made their money back.
Right.
And then everything else is gravy. So then the next key step is let's cut the staff because we don't need these. Heath Freeman, who's the president of Alden Global Capital, he walked into the newsroom and he famously said, "What do all these people do?" So he had a certain disdain for the people that work for the newspapers, but it was a gleam in his eye because he said, we can make some money. We can make lots of money out of this. And that's exactly what they did.
And the public facing part of it, you know, when Alden Global Capital or any hedge fund takes over a paper, they never say, we're going to strip this for parts. That's never the PR move. It's, in fact, grotesque because it's often, we're going to save this failing outlet.
That's exactly right. And in fact, after I got into the business, I mentioned the Denver Rebellion. Well, there were many, many events that then unfolded in the several years that followed. And one was that Alden Global Capital went after Gannett, which was the largest publicly owned newspaper chain in the country. You know, USA Today was their flagship paper, but they had local newspapers all around the country. And Alden Global Capital, that was in their materials to the shareholders. We save newspapers. Unfortunately for them, at the time, people like Julie Reynolds, who was an investigative reporter that's highlighted in our film, had done a lot of reporting. And by now, she's done over 100 articles just on Alden Global Capital and newspapers. And what Alden didn't see coming was they were going to lose the public relations battle.
Right.
And they tried to take over Gannett in 2019, and they failed. Now, there were other events that followed that that made it not so great for the public. But at that time, that was a big victory for journalists. And it was because now the news about Alden Global Capital and what they were about was out in the public. And they couldn't just do their machination behind closed doors.
Well, that sunshine or that transparency is maybe it's the baseline or the bottom line, but it's a necessary starting point. Clearly, this work is of particular meaning for people who work in journalism, sure, but also for everybody who sees and cares about the effects of media coverage on the whole range of issues that shape our lives and, you know, and on the relationship between, as we at FAIR always talk about, the relationship between the business of media and journalism's actual and potential societal impact. So I want to ask you about the impact campaign. What is the work that is going along with this film that's different than just, you know, having a series of screenings of the film around the country? What do you hope to be adding with the impact campaign?
Our impact campaign is just underway, and we're going to be in New York in this coming week with a couple of screenings at the Firehouse Cinema, DC TV on Tuesday, March 26th and Wednesday, March 27th. And we're going to be following that up with going to Minneapolis and Santa Cruz and Vancouver, Washington, and later Baltimore, New England, Pennsylvania, Washington, D.C., all over the country. What's the point of all that? Well, the film itself is a jumping off point for a discussion about journalism. And we show not only the causes of the hedge fund takeover of newspapers, which is massive in this country, but also some of the solutions that are happening with startups. There's over 400 nonprofit newspapers with newsrooms from 2 to 3 people to maybe 10 or 20 people. Not exactly taking the place of newspapers, but very, very substantial. There's also movement to get public funding of local journalism. And so we have the showings of the film followed by Q&A with generally I might be there either in person or virtually, and maybe somebody from the local community who's been paying attention to the local journalism crisis, up talking about it and interacting with the audience. And what can you do? It might be getting in touch with your local representative because some legislation is addressing this problem. Or it's expanding your knowledge of what are the local journalism outlets in your community that you're not even thinking about.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a way of getting people who are from the community and the journalists from that community to interact. Get them in the same room. Get them talking. And I think it's only by raising the public consciousness and raising the amount of discussion about this crisis in local journalism and how it affects democracy that we're going to find our way out of it. And the solutions in each community are somewhat different.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the particulars of that community. And I think that's actually a wonderful thing, because then the solutions become somewhat locally generated.
And how can folks learn more about this or maybe even bring it to their town?
Great question. Come to our website, strippedforpartsfilm.com, just like it sounds.
Mm-hmm.
If you somehow have trouble reaching it, just strip for parts and Google it, you'll get to our website. You can get in touch with us if you want to help arrange a screening in your community. We're here, and we have the ways to make that happen, and we can do that with you and with your help.
All right, then. We've been speaking with documentary filmmaker Rick Goldsmith. You can learn more about the film Stripped for Parts and the impact campaign that goes with it at strippedforpartsfilm.com. Thank you so much, Rick Goldsmith, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for reaching out to me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show is engineered by Riley Baer. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.